Donald, reel number 6. Could we carry on, Captain Donald, by my asking you whether you created your... to what extent you created your own routine at Montrose, and to what extent you had a routine imposed on you?
Well, this distance in time, I should say that to a very large degree, as far as patrols went, you just had to use one's own judgment, depending on the weather and visibility and that kind of thing, and carry out your own patrols and rely on the various light pistol signalling for the naval, who were keeping a close eye on each plane. I mean, they were always notified where you were going and that kind of thing. And on the other hand, and also the other part of it, was the being on call for an alert or to be sent for a definitely reported submarine or zeppelin. Which did occasionally happen. The trouble about the zeppelin alarm usually came during the night, because zeppelins only came over in the hours of darkness. It was rather absurd, but well, to please everybody, you had to put on a show of going out to chase zeppelins. I mean, you had about as much chance of, in those days when there was no radar, no anything, you hadn't even any night landing facilities, you had as much chance of spotting a zeppelin in the dark as a blind man catching a black cat in the Albert Hall in the dark. But the fact remains that you could take off, hoping to goodness the sun would rise before you ran out of petrol, because it was just too bad if you had to make a landing. Because we didn't have any night landing facilities, but I was very lucky. The few times I had to go out at night, the dawn had broken, so you were able to see what you were landing on. Otherwise, it would be a bit awkward.
Can I ask you this? This was now your third stint at Coastal Patrol work. You'd done it at Eastchurch, you'd done it at Dundee, and now you're doing basically Coastal Patrol work at Montrose. And from what we've discussed so far, it seems that on no occasion had you actually made contact with any enemy submarine or any zeppelins. The question I wanted to ask you was, what was your expectation of Coastal Patrol work at this time, and what was your valuation of its usefulness?
Oh, it was utterly essential. Because the enemy knew just as well as our people, they saw that these patrols were being carried out. And if we'd been carrying out no aircraft patrols, I don't know what they might have been up to. The North Sea, they might have begun to regard the North Sea as theirs. But the mere fact that you're known to be carrying out as nearly as possible what looks like a constant patrol, the enemy probably didn't know there was only one pilot doing it. But the fact remains, during that time, I don't say my presence there had anything to do with it, but during the time I was there, the submarine certainly made very doggle off the mouth of the, off that Firth of Forth and Firth of Tay area. And you must remember, war at sea is a bit like that, at least during the First War. The actual times when you saw the enemy were damn few and far between. In fact, up to the moment when I was speaking of at the moment, very, very few, if any, ships in the Royal Navy had seen the enemy. They're just waiting for him. It was a cat-and-mouse game on the North Sea.
Did you have any experience where the absence of coastal patrols, air patrols, in fact encouraged a good degree of enemy activity? The sort of other side of the coin?
No personal experience, because I was never absent. Yeah. I don't know what happened at other times.
Did the seaplanes that you were
they were land.
Did the airplanes you were flying at Montrose carry much armament?
By this time we had a light armament. We weren't entirely without teeth. The observer carried a rifle which fired explosive ammunition, which was for use if you got close enough to a zeppelin. It would have been quite effective. It was quite well-designed ammunition. And we carried either two or four light bombs. I think they were about 15 or 16 pounders, which might have done some damage to a submarine. Certainly would have given them a fright if you got close to him. but we were not able to attack as well as merely to signal the presence of a submarine.
Now, you were posted to Montrose in June of 1915, and by August you had moved back to Dundee. Why did you leave the base at Montrose?
Well, unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. And what happened was that the army, to whom Montrose was about their first custom-built station, just the same as the Dundee seaplane station had been ours, they wanted to move back in as a training station. So they began to... They fixed it up with the Admiralty, but they certainly began to show signs of moving back in, so I had to show some early signs of moving out. And so I was posted back to the Dundee seaplane station, and there was a certain amount of... Some of my five planes were removed down to an airfield near Drem, which is still quite famous in the Second War. But in the meantime, I found myself stuck at Dundee, and with the same seaplanes. So I put in a very urgent request to be given some sea time, if possible, to be transferred to HMS Engadine, where my great chum, Rafe Sawley, well, he was a flight sub-lieutenant in Engadine. So I'm pleased to say in October, about 3 weeks after getting, or shortly after, yes, shortly after getting back to the Dundee station, I was able to get posted to Engadine, small aircraft carrier, who was based at that time based off Granton on the 1st of 4th.
Can I ask you this in connection with Engadine? To what extent had your training and experience so far with seaplanes equipped you for this particular posting?
Oh, I think it was, bar the difference of being hoisted up by a crane and lowered by a crane, it was all part and parcel of the same picture. And also the fact that the seaplanes in Engadine were equipped with a form of wireless, which made our longer patrols of some use.
Could you describe HMS Engadine for me, what she was like as a seaplane carrier? Give me your first impressions of her, if you can.
She was a marvellous little ship. She didn't look marvellous. In fact, first sight, a lot of people would laugh when looked at her. She was a converted cross-channel packet belonging to the Southeastern and Chatham Railway, I think. About 1,400 tons, not a very big ship. And built a aircraft hangar for seaplanes on the aft deck, which gave her a slight permanent list. She was a wee bit top-heavy, but she had mighty fine engines with a very good ton of speed. You could do 23 knots, which was slightly more than the Grand Fleet could do, but was the sort of top speed of the battle cruisers. That's why we were sitting down there in the 1st of 4th trying to be useful to the battle cruisers. And all in all, she's a rather marvellous little ship. In that shed we carried four short seaplanes, wings folded, of course, and two Schneider Cup SUP with small single-seater fighters, which are delightful machines to fly, very like a land-based fighter. And they, with wings folded, also sat in the middle of the shed, so that we got six aircraft into that relatively small shed. It was very good work, very good work indeed.
Could you describe for me Engadine's routine operations at this time, when you first joined her in October 15?
At that time she was moored off Granton, which is just due north of Edinburgh. The main reason being we needed a good deal of room for taking the seaplanes off, and that we didn't consider there was just too much room above the fourth bridge, whereas the battle cruisers themselves and all the other ancillary ships were moored above the bridge. So to a certain degree we were a little bit cut off from the battle cruiser fleet, of which we were a part. But our not being a CNC, I can't just tell you the overall plan, but I think the overall plan was that we went out with the battle cruisers when they made the occasional sweep into the North Sea or up round the Scarpa Flow, which you must understand was very occasional, because you don't just take an expensive armada like a fleet to sea casually. However, we went with them, and in between time we carried out both experimental tests, wireless tests, later on torpedo dropping, and also submarine patrols of the old type off the Firth of Forth, except we went a good deal further afield, because our short seaplanes, which were very good ones fitted with the Canton Une engine, and were fitted with wireless, so that we could get signals back from the spot. That extended our range. I mean, we could go about 100-odd miles out into the North Sea and have a good look round.
You mentioned that one of your early duties on Engadine were these occasional sweeps which she made with the battlecruiser squadron, for whom she was supposed to provide air support. Could you describe, in such detail as you can manage, what those sweeps were like from your point of view?
It's rather difficult to describe a non-event, but we went along. The question of air support hadn't really been considered a great deal yet, because it just hadn't been envisaged by the fleet itself, although Vice Admiral David Beatty of the Battle Cruisers was beginning to realize the potentiality of aircraft. He was the real Nelson Touch fighting admiral. But as far as the individual pilot's part in a sweep of the battle cruisers through the North Sea, well, it was just a matter of a very small aircraft carrier with a touch of speed who could keep up with the battle cruisers sweeping round in a circle, probably starting from the Firth of Forth and ending up in Scarpa Flow in the Orkneys, and in between you swept round a very large expanse of very dark grey, very lumpy looking water. In fact, one of our seamen, when all letters from the ship always had to be read in case of any censored information, but this bit wasn't censored, his letter actually, writing home, said, "Dear Mother, I looks out of my porthole and I sees miles and miles of bugger all." That meant he was at sea. But the actual question of carrying out a sweep is, it's a case of hours or two or three days of extreme monotony sweeping around the North Sea and into Scarpa Flow, and then after a spell in Scarpa Flow of doing some various exercises, wireless exercises and so on, then you sweep back down again.
During the course of these sweeps, did the aircraft themselves, the seaplanes on Engadine, play any part in the exercise?
During most of the sweeps so far, there was no urgency, and it wouldn't have been necessary, it wouldn't have been feasible anyway, because it was purely a matter of the sea was too rough for a seaplane to be lowered into the water, let alone take off. Mm. That was our trouble. We had no facilities for taking off the deck or landing on the deck, and even if we had, the deck was usually pitching to an angle of about 45 degrees. The question was, Later on, there was going to be the occasional event when we were able to use sea flames and they were mighty useful. But at this stage, 1915, there wasn't a great deal we could do except just to be among those present.
Could you describe for me the mechanics of putting seaplanes off Engadine and then taking them aboard again?
Well, with practice, we really were able to do it pretty quickly. As on a shore station, each seaplane was on its own trolley, but with the wings folded, of course. The wheeled out on the aft deck, wings opened out, all the pins put in, wire bracing coupled up, engine got going, warmed up, one of the cranes swung inboard, and the hook put into a sling that was on the seaplanes themselves on the top plane, and you hooked on, the crane hove you up a few feet clear of the deck, swung you over the side, on the quarter, depending on which side you wanted to go in, which side she was lying, and which side the weather was on, and lowered you into the water, and as soon as your float steep touched the water, you got rid of that hook as quick as you could, and the chaps above who knew the stuff also got the hook up out of the way in case it fouled your propeller. And then, of course, the wind took you clear of the ship's side, and from then on it was just like any other seaplane takeoff, get her in head to wind and take off. But it didn't take so very long as it sounds. With practice and plenty of drill, it's surprising how quickly you could get a seaplane airborne from an old-fashioned aircraft carrier like that.